KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Of a grand bargain, long-term cuts to Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid are considered part of the deal.
It's a normal show. Oh, my God. Well, they said, I know it's hard, kid. That's the way it is.
I always encourage people to experiment. If they can't find it in the restaurants here in Seattle or it's far away, you know, get a great cookbook and try making it at home.
Experimenting with food, that's what Sarah Dickerman's going to talk to us about towards the end of the hour. We're also going to hear about a radio actor named Lucille Bliss who made a transition into voiceover and television. And we're going to talk about that fiscal cliff, taxes, cuts, and whether we should or should not go over it. But let's start with coal. Puget Sound Energy is an investor in and user of coal-fired power out of the coal strip plant of Billings, Montana. The Sierra Club doesn't like the plant. It says the plant is the dirtiest coal plant of the West. The folks who run it say that, quote, low-sulfur coal and state-of-the-art scrubbers restrict sulfur dioxide emissions to less than levels required by both Phase 1 and Phase 2 of the Clean Air Act. The plant also meets Environmental Protection Agency standards for nitrogen oxide emission. So if true, is the Sierra Club campaign really about the coal strip plant itself or an opportunity to publicize their opposition to the use of coal in the American energy portfolio? And if so, what replaces it? PSC often touts its green energy portfolio. They say they're planning to triple their existing supply of renewable energy by 2020. So how does any coal use fit into that equation? Coal plants generate 42% of U.S. electricity. And what impact would closing even one plant have on the planet? Andy Wappler is Vice President of Corporate Affairs at Puget Sound Energy. He joins us on the phone. Andy Wappler, thanks for talking to us.
You bet. Thanks, Steve.
And Ann Hedges is Chief Lobbyist with the Montana Environmental Information Center. Ann Hedges, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
So let's first take a look at this coal strip plant. What's the problem with it, and what do you want to see done?
Is that directed at me? Because
yes, I have
plenty of answers for that.
Yeah, question. You, Ann.
Thank you. Well, the coal strip plant is a dirty old coal plant. There's just no way around that. It is a plant that was built in the 70s and the 80s. It is in serious need of upgrade. It has serious contamination problems. It's currently contaminating groundwater and surface waters in the area. It has enormous liabilities. Those liabilities are increasing. But probably the highest priority for us, the reason that it needs to be focused on, is it is the second largest coal plant west of the Mississippi. It is the eighth biggest greenhouse gas polluter in the United States. Little old Montana has the eighth biggest greenhouse gas polluter in the United States. That speaks volumes. It is the dirtiest coal plant in the western United States as far as greenhouse gases are concerned. There is no source in the western United States that produces more greenhouse gases than coal strip. We think that Puget Sound Energy, as a utility that believes in green energy, needs to start planning now to get off this dirty coal source. It's bad for our economy, it's bad for your economy, and the liabilities are mounting. And it's very, very bad. It's a terrible risk for consumers in Washington State.
So what about the what the coal plant itself says on its website? It agrees with you. It's second largest coal-fired plant west of the Mississippi. Uses a rail's worth of coal every rail car's worth of coal every 5 minutes, but it is they use low sulfur coal. They say they have state of the art scrubbers. They're meeting the requirements of the federal law. Are they not telling the truth?
Not always. You know, when you don't look, you don't find. There are no air quality monitors in the town of Coal Strip. And we have expert reports showing that they are going to be violating EPA's new one-hour standard for sulfur dioxide. That is a health-based standard. There is a reason that this county in Montana has one of the highest asthma rates in our state. The emissions of SO2 and nitrogen oxides from this facility are larger than all of the permitted plants in Montana combined. This is a facility that has massive emissions. These emissions, that the emission controls on this facility, when they have them for certain pollutants, are antiquated. When they say that they have state-of-the-art technologies for sulfur dioxide, that is a myth. They have state-of-the-art technology from the 1970s installed. There's much better technology today that does a better job of removing these harmful air pollutants. And we believe this plant either needs to install those, really invest, or it needs to plan for retirement. And the thing that makes the most sense in today's economy is to plan for that retirement and do it in a thoughtful way over time so that workers are taken care of and so that the environment is cleaned up. This is a massive liability for Puget Sound ratepayers. There's just no way around that.
What's your timeline for closing it down?
We don't have a timeline. We believe that we need to sit down with the utilities that have invested in this facility, and we need to reach a solution that works for ratepayers, that works for the utilities, that guarantees reliability in the energy system.
Well, 3 years.
And it's affordable.
3 years, 10 years, 50 years?
You know, if you look at Washington State shellfish industry, we don't have that much time. You have a $270 million industry that is already at risk from climate change because of ocean acidification. The time was years ago to begin planning for this transition. We certainly don't have time to waste in planning for that transition. But we do need to factor in all sorts of variables as we move forward. But I would say this plant needs to shut down as soon as possible. But, you know, that is a calculus that will take some really thoughtful discussion.
All right. Well, and that's Ann Hedges, who is with the group that is looking at this Colstrip plant that PCE, Puget Sound Energy, is an investor in and user of. She is chief lobbyist with the Montana Environmental Information Center. Andy Wappler, I want to get your response to some of these things. On the Colstrip's own webpage, the company claims it's responsible for more than 3,700 jobs in Montana, including 380 at the plant and up to 400 at the nearby mine that provides coal for the plant. But you heard the calculation. Let me start with that calculation of whether it's accurate to say that the plant is as clean as it's being stated on the webpage.
Well, I do think that's accurate, Steve, and certainly to the point about the improvements. We've made improvements around $50 million in recent years around emissions for both nitrous oxide, sulfur, and mercury. So I do think the plant meets the standards. But one place where I certainly agree with Ann is on her point that the time was right years ago to begin for that transition. And frankly, that's why we began that planning years ago. PSE is the largest owner and operator of wind power in the Northwest, and the second largest utility owner and operator of wind power in the country. And in fact, we have more generating capacity in our portfolio today from wind than we get from Colstrip. We actually opened our first wind plant in 2005, a year before Washington voters approved the Renewable Energy Act here in the state. So certainly the time was years ago to begin that plan, and that's why we've been aggressive.
But what's
open wind plants? We have energy efficiency programs. They're some of the largest in the nation. But we also know that people have to pay the bill today. And so far, we have about $1.5 billion in operating renewable energy equipment today, wind power and hydro. That's a big investment. And we know in this economy, the next steps need to come. But the question of how fast and how expensive in today's economy is one we take seriously.
All right. Well, first of all, is Colstrip the second dirtiest plant west of the Mississippi?
I think that claim doesn't take into account the fact that it's a very large plant. And for the amount of energy it produces, it's a clean plant. If you just look at the total emissions, yes, they are large. But that's a bit of a ringer because it doesn't take into account the fact that it is an enormous power producer, not only for us, but for other states. Certainly, though, the transition's already underway, and coal won't be a fuel of the future, which is why we're building the fuels of the future today, building aggressively into wind power. I don't think anybody disagrees that the future path is different than the past.
Well, the Department of Energy disagrees. I mean, they see coal having a future. That's why they continue to put money into what they call clean coal technology, capture and storage. I mean, is that the plan for the Montana coal, that it goes to it still gets burned but in a different capacity, or is PSE see it shutting down in the next few decades?
Well, that probably depends on how effective those potential technologies are that would mean clean coal and coal carbon sequestration. You know, right now those are ideas and technologies, but they aren't in operation on a commercial scale, and there are a lot of unknowns about the cost. And as Ann points out, if the future liabilities for the plant, say around emissions or new technologies, grow so large that they aren't sustainable, they won't be sustainable. And we will look at other alternatives that make better sense economically. The trouble is, a lot of that is speculation today. What we do know, though, is that wind power works. We're adding it to our portfolio. We also know, though, that the wind doesn't always blow, so we still need plants that we can control on and off because we know our customers want the power to work every day.
But what's the short-term scenario for the Colstrip plant? Does it continue to burn coal and emit at the amount it's emitting for the next 3 years, 5 years, 8 years?
The short term is that it probably does continue to operate the way it does today, and today it is fully compliant. If those laws change and become more stringent, we will continue to either operate in compliance with those laws or make the decision that it's best to find an alternative. But today, that plant is fully compliant.
Well, but what about five? I mean, it's hard to have a clean energy portfolio, isn't it? And at the same time, still have coal being burned and putting CO2 and other gases, greenhouse gases, into the atmosphere and think we're making progress towards a cleaner planet. So how does PSE sort of take those two things together? We're going to have both a clean energy portfolio and a coal-fired power plant?
Well, I think the answer is we certainly need to keep driving more energy efficiency. So we're talking about fewer power plants of all kinds in the future, because energy efficiency is certainly the best bang for the buck and the best thing for the environment. And that's why we continue to have $100 million in grants and rebates to our customers today, from residential to business, to be more energy efficient. So that's number one. You know, hopefully we're talking about fewer power plants, not what kind in the future. But we certainly have to follow where the law and the regulations are today. And right now there isn't a lot of clarity about what the cost of carbon will be, because there isn't a lot of clarity about what the law will be in the future. And that does make these decisions tough going forward.
That's Andy Wappler with Puget Sound Energy, the Puget Sound Energy coal strip plant. The Sierra Club says it's the dirtiest coal-burning power plant in the western states, the eighth dirtiest nationwide. So, and Hedges, what's the Sierra Club and your group's strategy here? Are you going to, for example, pursue lawsuits? Are you going to try to prove that their emissions are in violation of the current standards?
We believe we have plenty of evidence that they are in violation of current standards.
So will you go to court?
We already have gone to court. And, in fact, the state of Montana has filed an enforcement action against this facility for its 1,000 acres of leaking coal sludge ponds. These are ponds that have already contaminated. Ponds is a misnomer, really. But they are enormous receptacles for their sludge, and they have been leaking into the groundwater for decades. And the state has known about this for over a decade, finally issued an enforcement action this summer. And we're incredibly frustrated because the enforcement action doesn't actually give them time frames by which they have to clean this facility up.
What is it?
Just a few years ago, these owners, including Puget Sound Energy, reached a settlement with some of the neighboring landowners whose drinking water was contaminated. And they paid $25 million to those landowners. And that money didn't go towards cleanup. They haven't even begun to start cleaning up the groundwater contamination at that site. And those liabilities are massive. So it is not in compliance with the law. They know that. The state has an outstanding enforcement action against them. So let's start there, because really they have massive liabilities. They have water quality liabilities. We know that the mine site that provides the coal to that facility has been contaminating groundwater on and off that mine site. We have filed a lawsuit on that. We believe that when state regulators refuse to do their job, when EPA is non-responsive, that unfortunately, the only action left is to use the judicial branch of government and to force the state to do its job, to force the state to make them clean up their act. That includes their existing water contamination problems, their air quality problems. And it's not that Sierra Club says that this is the eighth biggest polluter in the United States. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency says this is the eighth biggest greenhouse gas source in the United States. That's a really big facility. And for a company that is so committed to green energy, it means it understands its consumers' desire, and its consumers' desire is to have a greener portfolio. I think Washington State is on cutting edge when it comes to green portfolios, both energy efficiency measures and renewable energy measures, and that's terrific. But you can't be moving forward and advertising those programs without also including a discussion in how you are going to get off the dirtiest form of energy production in the United States today. PSE is the biggest owner of the Colstrip plant. The Colstrip plant has massive liabilities. Those liabilities will be passed on to the consumers in the state. And it seems like it's time for an open discussion about how Puget Sound Energy intends to get off this dirty source that is going to do nothing but create more risk for consumers in the future.
All right, Ann Hedges, Chief Lobbyist, Montana Environmental Information Center. Andy Wappler, I'm going to give you the last word here, Vice President of Corporate Affairs. Do you face these liabilities, and are they going to be passed on to consumers? And if this is a dirty plant with lots of liabilities, how are you going to pay for it?
Well, if those liabilities do come, that changes the economics, and that probably does mean that the plant's closing date is sooner rather than later. But I was at one of our rate case hearings this last winter. We had several members of the Sierra Club there. They were great. They were excited. We'd opened our third wind plant here in Washington State. And there were also advocates for low-income customers who said, we have folks who can't take another rate increase. And we're trying to balance those two demands. We have a lot of customers who want us to be greener, and so do we. We also have a lot of customers who are elderly and low-income and see more spending as something that's hard for them in this economy. We're trying to balance the two as best as we can.
All right. Well, we'll hear if this discussion continues. I appreciate you taking the time, Andy Wappler.
Thank you.
And Ann Hedges, I appreciate you taking the time. We're taking a look at the Colstrip power plant that PSE owns and operates in Montana. Andy Wappler is Vice President of Corporate Affairs at Puget Sound Energy. Ann Hedges is Chief Lobbyist with the Montana Environmental Information Center. We have links to their sites and the information at KUOW.org. This is Weekday.
It's 10:22. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. From Nirvana and Mudhoney to the Fleet Foxes and Shabazz Palaces, Seattle-based Sub Pop Records has played an influential and unique role in rock music history. Later today, we'll take a tour of the label and hear from label Vice President Megan Jasper. That comes your way this afternoon at 12:30.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Girls School with an open house Tuesday, December 4th. SGS is committed to empowering young women grades 5 through 8 to be leaders in their communities with a program focused on collaboration, integration, and problem solving. More at seattlegirlsschool.org.
Clouds and showers, 51 degrees in Seattle, working towards a high of 53 today. We're expecting clouds and rain the rest of today, tonight, and tomorrow. Tonight's low 44, tomorrow's high reaching 53.
All right, now we're going to look over the fiscal cliff again. Should there be a grand bargain to avert the fiscal cliff? That's what Republican House Speaker John Boehner was saying today. He said there's been no substantive progress in talks on how to address the looming tax increases, spending cuts, and the borrowing limits, because he says the White House is not serious about spending cuts. But what are those spending cuts, and how should they look? And what is this fiscal cliff? Let's take a look at it again with Michael Lind. He directs the Economic Growth Program at the New America Foundation. He's the author of Land of Promise, an economic history of the United States. He's been writing about these issues. He called the fiscal cliff a lie, at least the headline writer did. I think he probably did as well in a recent Salon article. Let's start there. Michael Lind, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
I'm going to bring in State Senator Steve Hobbs, who's been looking at these issues as well. He is a Democratic state senator from Lake Stevens and Washington State co-chair of the National Fix the Debt campaign. Steve Hobbs, thanks for talking to us.
Oh, thank you.
So, Michael Lind, is the fiscal cliff a lie?
Well, no, that was the headline writer's headline.
Yeah.
It is important to the economy that we not go over the fiscal cliff, although some people point out what it would be more of a fiscal slope or a fiscal curb. I think there would be enough deleterious things. With government checks being delayed, lines of credit being held up, that it is very important for there to be some kind of deal. by the end of the year. In my opinion, that deal should be a small bargain. It should not be a grand bargain. Fix the Debt and these various other organizations supporting a grand bargain have argued is that we can't deal with the expiration of the Bush tax cuts, expiration of temporary payroll tax cuts, and the sequester left over from last summer's debt ceiling without a massive comprehensive reform of Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, you know, for the next 20 or 30 years. That's a completely arbitrary yoking of unrelated things. Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid did not contribute in any way either to the post-recession deficit, which is the result of the recession, two unfunded wars, and the Bush tax cuts. And they have nothing to do with the fiscal cliff deadline, which is mostly a result of maneuvering on Capitol Hill by the Republican Party last summer. So we do need to address entitlements in the very long term. We should not do that in a pell-mell, hasty, ill-considered way under some sort of deadline, either by the end of the year or the beginning of next summer.
What would happen, do you think, if Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid were part of a grand bargain right now? What would those bargains look like?
Well, the White House and the Democrats have indicated, I don't know how accurately, that Social Security will be left out, which indeed it should, because Social Security is fully funded until the year 2033. And from 2033 until 2086, it will pay for three-quarters of its promised benefits. So really, there's no reason even to talk about Social Security. Medicare and Medicaid are partly funded out of general revenues. They're part of the ordinary budget, and they do need to be dealt with. But again, that's a long-term problem. Most likely, you'll end up with a fix for these pressing issues, like the Bush tax cuts and avoiding the sequester, with promises for some kind of long-term framework to reduce costs in Medicare and Medicaid over the next 10 or 20 years. At least that's what's being reported.
So kick the can down the road on those bigger issues.
Well, it would be better to do that than to come up with a hastily done, poorly designed deal under the pressure of a completely arbitrary deadline.
That's Michael Lind. State Senator Steve Hobbs, Fix the Debt campaign. You want to see this arbitrary deadline enact some grand bargain?
Yes, definitely. I think we need to move now. The public is demanding that across the United States, certainly here in Washington State. We have a situation where we're accumulating debt. We have a $16 trillion debt, deficit of $1.7 trillion, of a budget of $3.55 trillion. It's almost a third. We continue going down this road. By 2025, revenues will be only able to finance interest payments, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. You know, Fix the Debt, we want to get this problem solved, and we'd like to have all options on the table. You know, we're not closed to any idea, but to do nothing and to stare at each other and hope for a perfect plan will not get you anywhere. It will continue to cause this problem.
But you really want the government to operate under a sort of Damocles of 3 weeks to solve these basic and structural problems?
You know, I think now's the time to do it. Now, if they decide, well, we need another month or an extra week, you know, I guess that'd be fine as long as it's a bipartisan plan that we're moving forward, that it's going to pass, that we're going to deal with the issues of, you know, reining in spending, raise some revenue, and reform our entitlement programs.
What does reforming the entitlement programs mean to you? What happens to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security under your Fix the Debt idea?
Well, for example, when it comes to Social Security, you know, back in the 1950s, there were 16 workers for every one worker on Social Security. Now it's like 3 to 1. You know, there's a lot of ideas out there that we could do. We could lift the cap. We could perhaps increase the minimum age of retirement for new workers. There's a whole slew of ideas out there. We're not wedded to any one idea, but to go on this course and to say that Social Security, there's nothing wrong with it, when the fact of the matter is the number of workers that supports one worker in a pay-to-go program is not working. More money is going out than is coming in.
But well, let me come back to that in a minute. What about Medicare? What would you do for Medicare? Because we saw during the campaign different approaches to Medicare. What do you think needs to fund Medicare properly?
Right. Again, another slew of ideas out there. There's reducing excess payments to hospitals for medical education, extending medical drug rebate to dual eligibles out there, cut Medicare payments to bad debts. There is means testing on certain folks. Is someone who make millions of dollars, do they need health insurance when they could probably already pay for it? Again, we're not closed to any ideas. We want to see everything on the table so that we can move forward to save these valuable programs.
But in 3 weeks? I mean, you're talking about changing Medicare in a way that could fundamentally, some people argue, change the way we see the social compact.
Right. And again, you know, if it takes a little longer, I mean, if they all came together and said, just give us one more month or two more weeks, I could understand it. It's a complicated issue. But the problem is we keep on kicking this can down the road. There are plans already out there, Simpson-Bowles, and you could use that as a baseline. I know that some people don't like that, but use it as a baseline. Make adjustments off of it. We're not wedded to any one plan. And there's a lot of ideas out there that have already been studied and worked out.
Steve Hobbs is a Democratic state senator from Lake Stevens. He's the Washington State co-chair of the National Fix the Debt campaign. Michael Lind is with the New America Foundation. Michael Lind, in your article, you point out the percentage of spending the U.S. does on its social safety net overall and what percentage that is of government spending and what percentage that is of private spending. And one of the things you point out is that health care is seen as private, even though it's got a lot of tax breaks for those of us who get health care from our businesses. What would you do differently? How would you want to see people see things differently? Yeah, to the budget.
Is healthcare costs growing faster than economic growth? And that is unique to the United States because we have concentrated power on the part of medical providers, hospitals, pharmaceutical companies, doctors who are very influential in politics. And every other industrial country, whether it has single-payer insurance or private insurance, it doesn't matter. What they do is the healthcare system is nonprofit. And they also have something called all-payer regulation, which is essentially utility-style price regulation of what doctors, hospitals, and drug companies can pay. Now, if the Fix the Debt campaign were serious about reducing long-term medical costs, they would not be arguing for raising the Medicare eligibility age in order to ration access to health care for the elderly. They would be wanting to expand the Medicare program, which negotiates lower prices than private insurers are able to do. And if the Fix the Debt campaign were serious about the deficit, they would not be arguing for using the Simpson-Bowles plan as a baseline, because Simpson-Bowles wants to lower tax rates for the rich, even below where they are now. Simpson-Bowles calls for the government share of GDP in the middle of the 21st century, decades from now, being lower than the 23% it was when Ronald Reagan took office in a society with an aging baby boomer population. So let's be clear, Fix the Debt is a corporate-funded campaign set up by Pete Peterson, initially a right-wing billionaire who has spent decades promoting cuts in Social Security and Medicare. And what they're hoping to do is to use the excuse of the fiscal cliff to ram through permanent cuts in Social Security and Medicare, partly in order to pay for lower tax rates for the rich. Now, Senator Hobbs may say they're open to ideas, but that is what the Fix the Debt campaign is. They have been pushing versions of the Simpson-Bowles plan, which the American people reject. 67% oppose Medicare eligibility raises to 67. 60% of Americans favor raising taxes on the rich, tax rates above $250,000 a year. So what the American people want is the exact opposite of the Simpson-Bowles plan that Fix the Debt has been pushing for months.
What about tax rates that go towards hitting the middle class, or tax breaks that are removed that hit the middle class, like the health care exemption, the cost exemption?
Well, if you're going to get rid of the health care exemption, in the long run, we need to have a health care system which is completely decoupled from employers. So in the long run, you want to phase that out. Under Obamacare, which, let's recall, was inspired by conservative models like Romney and Romney Care in Massachusetts, and by the Heritage Foundation health care plan of the 1990s, you would replace the employer health care tax deduction with an individual one that follows individuals everywhere. You could have done it other ways, but, you know, expanding Medicare and Medicaid, for example, but this is the way the country has chosen to go. What you cannot do is eliminate the employer health deduction and then not do anything. You're just going to be stripping millions and millions and millions of people of health care. So in the long run, do we need to raise revenue from the middle class as well as the elites? Yeah, of course. One of the things that we've been pushing at the New America Foundation is a federal value-added tax. It's a kind of a version of a sales tax. Most other governments in the industrial world use one, so you don't have to rely excessively on personal income taxes and payroll taxes. That's the debate we should be having, which is how to raise adequate revenue for our own welfare state, which by international standards is very small and ungenerous.
Steve Hobbs, you look over the edge of the fiscal cliff, and there's all sorts of things to discuss down there. In three weeks, can we do all that?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you're answering. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, just to clarify, I'm the state chair of Fix the Debt here in Washington State. But in terms of just kind of responding to some of these accusations here, you know, first of all, we are open to everything. It's a baseline that we're going with. For example, if we want to increase taxes on those making over $250,000, you know, that's fine, except this is about simple math. The simple math is $3.55 trillion budget, but it's $1.7 trillion deficit. I mean, if you just go by what Lynn is saying, then we're going to have to increase taxes by $2 trillion if you want to expand all those programs and keep and put our budget back on track. That's not going to work. We're saying use all forms out there, all avenues to get our country back on the right path. Not just close loopholes, but maybe look at taxes on the wealthy, but also look at other things out there that maybe, like I said, means testing on aspects of Medicare and Social Security. Let's look at the different ideas that are out there to put this country back on the right path.
All right. Well,
again, if you have $1.7 trillion in deficit, you are not going to be able to get out of this by putting $2 trillion of new taxes. That's not going to work. It's almost reflective of the other side of the argument, where you have the ultra-conservatives say we need to cut our way out of this. Well, that's ridiculous. You can't do that either.
All right, well, Michael Lynn, let me ask you a last question, Steve Hobbs, just real quick, and then I'll let you respond. You look over the fiscal cliff, you see all sorts of cuts. You're never going to see the kind of cuts being proposed in defense. You have even talked about why not just go over the – well, you haven't, but some people have talked about why not just go over the fiscal cliff, and then Congress comes and says, well, let's back it up. Let's make sure we get those tax cuts back in place that we think are adequate, but let's have the cuts.
Well, that might be give political cover to the Republican Party to have cuts, because if the rates go up, then they can say, oh, well, we're cutting taxes now, at least for the 98% below the top. But look, let's make one thing clear. It's economically illiterate to say that we have to solve the deficit solely by spending cuts and by tax increases. The rate of economic growth, it makes a profound difference. Of course we're in a deficit. We should be in a deficit. When a country has suffered the greatest collapse since the Great Depression, all industrial countries have had to go into deficit spending to prevent contracting the economy further. The whole reason we want not to have this sequester and the automatic expiration of the Bush tax cuts is because it might throw the economy into recession if we suddenly shrink, cut taxes, and raise taxes and cut spending too quickly. So even the chairman of the Fix the Debt campaign, Senator Simpson and Mr. Bowles, admit that we don't want to close the deficit too quickly in the next few years because that would throw the economy back into recession in a very weak recovery. So since they agree with that, the question is, why should we use this arbitrary deadline? They themselves have set a deadline of July 4th. If they can't make December 31st, as I understand it, for Fix the Debt to get all this stuff done. These are both completely arbitrary deadlines. We have 21 years to deal with Social Security. We have decades, you know, to tinker with Medicare and Medicaid and the healthcare system. There's absolutely no reason not to go ahead, solve these pressing issues like the expiration of the Bush tax cuts and getting rid of the sequester, and deal with these things, which are separate issues, on a separate timeline.
All right, let me let Steve Hobbs have the last word on that. Steve Hobbs, these are just deadlines that Congress created itself in order to try to get it to act, but 3 weeks seems like an awful tight time to try to reform the entire government.
Well, right, but if you look at this, we haven't done anything for the last, 10, 20 years, and this issue has been looming over our heads the whole time. You know, I'm an elected official. I know what it's like to take votes and try to negotiate, and unless you have pressure, you're not going to do anything, because the problem with this whole issue of the deficit in our economy is you got to take the hard right over the easy wrong. And the easy wrong is to do nothing and to hit on these little side issues that really don't get you anywhere. Quite frankly, members of Congress have got to take the hard right and take the vote and get us out of this mess.
All right, gentlemen, I appreciate you illuminating the issue. I know these are the same kind of discussions they're having back in behind closed doors in D.C. Michael Lynn directs the Economic Growth Program at the New America Foundation. Steve Hobbs is a Democratic state senator from Lake Stevens and Washington State co-chair of the National Fix the Debt Campaign. We have links at our website at KUOW.org.
Facebook has had complaints about its privacy policy. Who can see your pictures? What personal data that apps can collect?
There's too many complex issues that need to be figured out. And actually, I just don't have enough time to go through everything to try and understand it all.
And Facebook privacy rules are about to change again. That story later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story and much more today from 3 until 6:30. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. Good morning, it's 10:41. I'm Andy Hurst.
Support for KUOW comes from the Dairy Farmers of Washington, where dairy farm compost goes to neighboring farms, vineyards, and orchards for growing blueberries, hops, and hay. More about what dairy families in Washington are doing to keep milk pure, fresh, and local is online at akeyingredient.com.
We have clouds and showers, 51 degrees right now in the U District. We also have an updated forecast from the National Weather Service. They say clouds and rain this morning, then becoming partly sunny this afternoon with a chance of showers, the high reaching 53. Chance of rain this evening, then rain likely overnight, the low in the mid-40s.
Support for KUOW comes from Evo, a ski and snowboard shop announcing the grand opening of their flagship store, now located at 35th and Stone Way, featuring technical outerwear and casual clothing from Burton, The North Face, Armada, and more. More online at evo.com/Seattle.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is Jack Benny talking.
Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
One of the things about looking back into the old-time radio era and taking a little radio retrospective is that the folks who created this era, either gone or leaving us. Voice actress Lucille Bliss died this month after performing voice work for more than 60 years, and she was still working last month. So we're going to take a look at her own career. Katie Sewell, you say Lucille Bliss loved the radio drama of the Golden Age, huh?
She did, and she loved it so much that that's why she became a voice actress. She loved radio, and she wanted to be a part of it. And she got involved pretty quick, performing small roles in radio dramas around the Bay Area where she was living. And then toward the end of the 40s, she got her big break in radio when she was cast alongside Edgar Bergen as Charlie McCarthy, the puppet's sweetheart. Here she is remembering a show that they did together.
A live show with audience. And I sat on the piano bench with Hoagy Carmichael, and he played Buttermilk Sky. And it was wonderful. And NBC gave me a farewell because they thought I was going to move to Hollywood to do the show.
But as she packs up her belongings to get ready to move to Hollywood, her phone rings, and here she is again.
It was NBC, and they said, Lucille, unpack your trunks. I said, why? He said, Bergen's been canceled. There's no more show. I said, no more show? Oh, my God. Well, they said, I know it's hard, kid, but that's the way it is.
That's the way
that's
it is.
Show business, baby. I know. Hey, that's show business, kid. What'd she do?
Can you imagine how much of a letdown that would be? Well, rather than cancel her move to Hollywood, which was already in motion, she borrows $50 from a friend of hers and goes anyway, mainly because she heard that Walt Disney was going to be hiring for a new movie, one that I'm sure you've heard of.
A dream is a wish your heart makes when you're fast asleep.
Walt Disney's Cinderella. It was to be released in 1950, and Lucille Bliss was determined to be a part of it. But she was also very late to the audition. She had just arrived in Hollywood, and so she's not all that savvy. She's very young still at this point. And the cab driver that she hired to get her to Disney Studios wasn't very honest either. And she let it slip that she had $7.50. That's all the money she had. And he made sure to drive her in circles until she owed him all of that money. Had the driver actually driven her directly to the auditions, the cab ride would have cost her only about $3. So that tells you how long he was driving.
She was robbed.
She was robbed. And then by the time she arrived at Walt Disney Studios, the auditions were over. Thinking back on that day, Lucille says that she must have looked so sad and pathetic that they took pity on her because they let her audition, but they did not let her audition with a script because that had already been packed up and put away. So instead, she was allowed 20 minutes to ad-lib as many character voices as she could come up with.
Really? That's a great audition. I'd like to do that.
Yeah, and 6 months later, she ends up having to go back home because she runs out of money. 6 months later, she gets a call, and they tell her that she landed the role of the redheaded stepsister, Anastasia.
There's to be a ball.
A ball?
In honor of His Highness, the Prince.
Oh, the Prince!
And by royal command, every eligible maiden is to attend.
Why, that's us! And I'm so eligible!
That's her at the end being so eligible.
She's the eligible one, huh?
Yeah. In an interview done with her for the Archive for American Television, she gives us a great behind-the-scenes look at how the voice track for Cinderella was recorded.
I played the part of Anastasia, the redhead. Oh, your grace, oh, I'd love to dance Cinderella! She was a raucous Brooklynese gal. And every morning, Walt Disney himself would come in, talk to us, and say, you know, we're working on records. Because Walt Disney was the last producer to go to tape. Everybody else was on tape, but Walt always said the quality of acetate is far superior to the quality of tape, and I care about the quality. So he said, you have to be very careful, rehearse, and know your parts, because if you make a mistake, everybody has to do the part over again. You cannot edit and acetate a record. You can clip tape, but not that.
So absolute perfection in the recording, which is sort of like live radio. There's no easy fix for a mistake. You either live with the mistake or you do it over. And that's how Walt Disney was like. I mentioned earlier that Lucille got into acting because she loved radio drama, but she was also really big on television. You often think of radio drama people as being like, TV, no. She was thrilled by television and she wanted to get into it as fast as possible. And she got her wish. In fact, she was the very first voice of a cartoon series that was made specifically for television. Very first cartoon ever, called Crusader Rabbit. And she played both of the main characters. So that meant acting opposite herself.
Don't you know where Texas is?
Get the guy. Don't we know where Texas is? Golly, that's right. We don't. Just a minute. I'll look it up.
Yeah, wait a minute.
This dictionary will tell us. Let's see now. T, termite, territory, terror, Texas. Here it is, Texas. It's right in between terror and Thanksgiving.
Yeah, Thanksgiving? Oh, boy. I love Thanksgiving.
Again. That is her, both parts. It doesn't sound like she would be able to play that male role, but she can. And that was in the 50s. But the voice role she's remembered the most didn't come until 20 years later in the 1980s. I think most people listening who grew up in the 80s will remember this voice very clearly.
Oh, Poppy,
marvelous smurfy flowers, perfect for decorating the springtime banquet. Don't they smell smurfy, puppy?
I grew up in the 80s. I do not recognize that character till the very end.
That's Smurfette, of course.
I did not follow the Smurfs like you. I guess I was already an adult.
Yeah, I was a child in the 80s. So Smurfette was the only female member of the Smurfs. And it was a character that Lucille Bliss loved playing.
We did it so long, 10 years. She felt so real to me because I created her voice so I could feel her emotions. It may sound strange, but it's true. If you do something for a long time and you created it, you begin to feel the emotion, you begin to think like the character and talk like you. It takes over.
So like I said at the start of the segment, Lucille Bliss played characters on radio, television, film for over 60 years, and she was working right up to October of this year. She died earlier this month on November 8th at the age of 96 years old.
Wow. That's a remarkable career. Thanks, Katie.
You're welcome. And now, the sound of the day.
Well, that's the sound of Brussels sprouts cooked in bacon grease with bacon and chestnuts, held in a rectangular yellow vintage Pyrex dish with a glass lid. It's rattling. As she exits I-5 at 164th Street on the way to her father's house for Thanksgiving. Reminds us the dinner table. Remind us of the dinner table. What interesting sounds are you hearing that are reminding you of the dinner table or perhaps the breakfast? We haven't heard any good breakfast sounds. If we want to crack an egg, that'd be fine. What is the sound of your day? How does it start? How does it end? How does it go on? Record 30 seconds of it and send it to us, along with the story behind it. We need that story because, you know, Autumn, she recorded that story when she was exiting I-5. What story do you have? Weekday at KUOW.org, put sound of the day in the subject line. Now, a sound I'm hearing is the growling of my stomach. So Sarah Dickerman, who writes for Slate and New York Times and other publications, also writes at sarahdickerman.com. How are you, Sarah?
I'm good. I'm a little gravelly today, but I'm thinking about a very nice sound indeed. I'm thinking about the sound of yellow wax paper wrapped around a foot-long sandwich and the light crunch you get when you bite into a warm banh mi.
Ah, the banh mi. Always. What? Where do you like to get banh mis?
Well, you know, I think the classic, I'm afraid I'm not coming up with like a total, you know, off-the-path idea right now, because I think the classic for value delivered and swiftness and warmth, I really like Seattle Deli, which is on near the corner of 12th and Jackson. And, you know, everything's sub $3, which is Or maybe $3 and below, I should say, which is, you know, one of the great delights of the banh mi is that it's a good bargain. And, I like the way the texture of the bread is a big part of the pleasure of a banh mi, and I think they get it right there.
I love the debate of the banh mi. Cause, you know,
I'm setting myself up to have many recommendations come my way, and I welcome them.
We welcome them all. In our university district neighborhood where KOW is, there's the Saigon Deli's banh mi. It's very good. Tan V has a great banh mi. I'm sure I'm forgetting a whole bunch. So there could be just the banh mi tasting. I wonder if anybody, see already if somebody sent me, Seattle Deli, no way. It's all about... No, not yet, but I'll get the, as you say, we're going to get them soon. We're going to get some banh mi suggestions because there are so many great ones.
And I love that people have their favorites and their allegiances. At Seattle Deli, I really like their tofu sandwich, which is very, very nice and marinated. And I'm sort of a sucker. I kind of like a slightly softer texture inside the banh mi rather than, say, the slightly chewier barbecue pork, which a lot of people like too. And then, of course, there's always that wonderful thing. I guess I should define this in case someone hasn't tasted them before. Banh mi are these wonderful Vietnamese sandwiches that are made on a French-style bread that combine either cold cuts or tofu with pickly vegetables, usually carrot and daikon, a little bit of jalapeno, if you like it, some cilantro, and they're just wonderful.
There's the whole debate about whether there should be what kind of spread should be on there, right, in the banh mi, like mayonnaise or a hot mayonnaise or nothing. Or
yeah, I like a little mayonnaise in this case, and I also really, really like the ones that have the pork liver pate on them. At Seattle Deli, it's the special sandwich, has some pork liver pate on it, and it's just delicious. It's, you know, sort of a Vietnamese liverwurst.
Now, Sarah, you write that there's a great essay on this in Pot on the Fire, Further Exploits of a Renegade Cook, John Thorne.
Yeah, John Thorne is this one of these great curmudgeonly food writers who kind of dives into a given subject. Some of the other titles of the essays in this book are Quintessential Toast, another one on Desperately Resisting Risotto, or another one is on cooking crab cakes. And he sort of dives in and looks at all the lore about a given food and tries to find his own best way of making that particular food. And he's a really engaging writer. There's always a great essay and then also interesting recipes. It's about the process of being, he writes a lot about the process of being a cook and what you're seeking when you seek a new recipe.
I read John Thorne. I read Mouth Wide Open, A Cook and His Appetite.
Oh, yeah. Also great.
So do you find him somebody you turn to for inspiration?
I do, you know, and inspiration for writing as much as cooking, I'd say, because I really think his ability to dive deep is something I totally love, both in the process of cooking and in the reading. I really admire that about him, and he's funny and also, you know, admits when some things that we've raised up high maybe aren't as good as we want them to be. So, you know, I like that about him too.
All right, Sarah. Well, nobody's written me yet on other banh mi suggestions, but I'm sure you will. So, you said Seattle Deli down at in the ID 12th, right?
Yes.
12th and Jackson.
Yeah.
And also, I remember I like the Saigon Deli one. Oh, there's one in West Seattle that Katie has taken us to that has a great banh mi.
Okay.
Amity, remember the name of that place? I can't remember it either. All right, we'll find out what that one is.
Well,
if anybody else has any banh mi suggestions, shoot them our way.
Yeah, let's keep up the banh mi quest. I don't think there's one sole answer, and I think we should continue to explore it.
I think we may do that today. I appreciate you. I appreciate you talking to us, Sarah.
Thank you.
Take care. Sarah Dickerman writes at Slate, at New York Times. You can find lots of her writings at her own website, sarahdickerman.com. The banh mi, Seattle Deli, 12th, but you know, maybe there's others you want to suggest as well. We'll put a list of a lot of good banh mi's, but you know, include the story behind it, because we need to know why you think it's so great. Faux Aroma, that's the one in West Seattle, actually in Delridge, right? That's a good one too. And that's just three off the top of our heads. So shoot me some more, weekday at KUOW.org. Or you know what, I'll put the question up on our Facebook page, weekday on KUOW, and we'll get some other suggestions for good banh mi's and why that particular banh mi is so good. Weekday is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Bagano, Amin Al-Sadi, Alexander Garrettin, Daniel Anthony Goodwin are our interns. Andy Hurst is the engineer of this program. I appreciate you being with us today. Tomorrow in the program, we will have our news in review panel, take a look at what's happened in this past week. We're also going to look at Myanmar. Now that the president's back and some of our friends who've traveled there have explored it a little more, we're going to look at the history of that country one more time and see where they are going in the next few months and years. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle. Have a good day.
Good morning. It's 10:59. Stick around for NPR News coming up next.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Jewish Community School. For 20 years, committed to challenging the minds and inspiring the hearts of students kindergarten through fifth grade. A school day tour for prospective parents will be held December 11th at 9 a.m. More at sjcs.net.
Hey, it's John Moe. Join me for Wits, a new show with comedy, conversation, songs, and surprises. Recorded live at the Fitzgerald Theater.
Can you curtsy just with your neck?
Amy Sedaris, you're saying that it's okay to do a neck curtsy?
Yeah, he's tall.
We gotta run, run, run before those emus attack.
And then Bobcat Goldthwait was there. You know what he said?
I put my hands up in the air sometimes, say.
Wits with John Moe tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. This is 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.